Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We shouldn't discount the fact that in the last 12 months, we've seen China commission 9 new destroyers, 2 amphibious ships, and a nuclear-powered submarine. And so that puts it into context that we can't sit idly by and expect that we will be able to remain a credible defence power and presence in the region if we don't explore the best possible technologies and platforms.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast, brought to you by the ANU National Security College with support from policyforum.net. In this special episode, we kick off a mini-series exploring the AUKUS technology sharing arrangement, a year on from its announcement. Recently retired Vice Admiral Michael Noonan, former Chief of the Royal Australian Navy, joins Professor Rory Medcalf. They discuss the strategic challenges that led to AUKUS, the difficulties of implementing it, nuclear submarines, and the role of sea power for Australia. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to their elders past and present.
Welcome to this special National Security Podcast, looking at the AUKUS arrangement, the three-nation technology sharing arrangement between the United States, the United Kingdom and Australia that will, among other things, fundamentally change Australian sea power and introduce nuclear-powered submarines to the Royal Australian Navy. In the first of these podcasts, looking at the background of AUKUS, the implications of AUKUS, and in particular, the challenges ahead for Australia in particular in implementing this AUKUS arrangement, I'm really pleased to be joined by Michael Noonan, Vice Admiral retired, recently retired, Michael Noonan, former Chief of the Royal Australian Navy. Mike, it's great to have you with us on this National Security Podcast.
Thanks very much, Rory. It's great to be able to join you on such an important topic as we approach the 12-month anniversary since the AUKUS agreement was entered into. It's great to be able to share this opportunity with you.
So to get straight into the substance of this conversation, I'd like to discuss over the next little while the strategic challenges that led to AUKUS, some questions really about the role of sea power for Australia, some background on why nuclear submarines are special, and then perhaps a few questions about the challenge going forward. So I might kick off there, Mike, and just go straight to the AUKUS agreement being a response to a major deterioration in Australia's strategic environment. And I guess that's how I read it, especially the commitment to deliver for Australia a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. How do you perceive the strategic challenge for Australia in the Indo-Pacific?
Well, certainly, you know, the Indo-Pacific is Australia's backyard. It's our neighbourhood. It's vital for us as a maritime nation. And what we have seen in the last 10 years, and it's accelerating, is the rise of China, the great power competition that we've seen in the Indo-Pacific, particularly over the last 5 to 10 years. And this does bring with it great risk to Australia's ongoing maritime security and prosperity. We're not spectators in this. We're active participants in the region. And so it's vitally important that we're not just engaged, but we're doing things now that will ensure our security and prosperity into the future. So I think that the decisions that the government's taken with respect to our our defence, and particularly our hardware and platforms, really are important ones that the nation needs to understand and be committed to.
So if the strategic challenge is about great powers in the Indo-Pacific, and you refer to China in particular, what's the role of sea power for Australia in meeting that challenge? And I guess you have a certain view on this as a long-time Navy man, a former Chief of Navy. But what's the role of sea power, if I may, in meeting the strategic challenge?
Well, I think it's obvious when you look at it, Rory, in that you know, as we remember that Australia is a continent, we're an island, we're a maritime nation, we rely on maritime trade for our economic prosperity. And ultimately, the way that we are connected to the world by seabed and submarine cables is absolutely vital to our global trading system. And so if our access to the maritime environment was disrupted in any way, be that in terms of blockade of the sea routes that we use for trade, or disruption to the communication lines that that we rely upon, we would see a very significant and rapid deterioration of the security situation and our prosperity here in Australia and the region. As one of the larger countries and defence forces in the region, we've got a responsibility not only to Australia, but also to many of the smaller Southwest Pacific nations in terms of ensuring that they are able to prosper and that they have the security that they need to be able to enjoy sovereignty and the economic prosperity that we want to see everybody enjoy. So this is not about being anti-China. This is about seeing everybody have the right to access to the maritime environment in a free and prosperous way.
So that's sea power in the broad, but of course sea power can vary widely from, relatively light surface vessels performing constabulary missions through to the large amphibious assault vessels, the LHDs, to serious warfighting surface vessels with long-range strike. But what about submarines? Why do submarines matter in that context?
Well, submarines, Rory, as we all know, are a unique vessel. They allow a strategic presence that no other vessel can provide. They can operate a long way away from their home base. They are designed to operate undetected. It's all about stealth. And so what we've seen in the history of Australian submarines is the evolution of our submarines being able to operate not just around Australia, but within our region and globally in support of our national interests. And the big advantages, of course, is submarines is that they are largely undetected, except for when they need to come to the surface. And we've certainly enjoyed the period of the Collins-class submarines and the Oberon submarines before that, being able to conduct their missions, their covert missions, very successfully. As we move into a more contested environment and systems in our region that make submarines more detectable when they're on the surface, the only way to remain undetected is to not be on the surface. And so the great advantage of a nuclear-powered submarine over a conventional-powered submarine is that that periodic surfacing that typically occurs once or twice a day in a conventional-powered submarine does not need to occur in a nuclear-powered submarine, which, of course, restores our balance to use that strategic asset in the way the government should choose to.
So nuclear-powered submarines really have a distinct strategic advantage in that regard. And it's worth noting, of course, that Australia is hardly the first country to be introducing nuclear-powered submarines to the Indo-Pacific. I note that while there are nations in the region that are expressing some concern about Australia's ambitions, they're sometimes a little bit less silent on the fact that China, for example, has a substantial and growing nuclear power and indeed nuclear armed submarine fleet. But let's not go there at the moment. Let's just look a little bit further at the advantages that a nuclear powered fleet would have. I mean, you've talked particularly about detection. Is that the only issue? I mean, aren't there other issues about range and speed and so forth?
Yes, there are, of course, Rory. Nuclear powered submarines are absolutely have the advantage of range. Clearly, without the need to refuel, they can stay at sea for long periods of time, and can operate underwater for long periods of time. The limiting factor, of course, is the need to replenish the food for the crew. So you've got endurance. That's clearly a great advantage of a nuclear powered submarine. Speed, you mentioned that. Typically, a nuclear powered submarine could operate at a speed, in excess of twice that of a conventionally powered submarine in many cases. So the only way to chase a nuclear powered submarine is with a nuclear powered submarine. And then, of course, we've got the issue of detectability, which is a combination of both of those attributes. If it can go fast and can stay underwater longer, it makes it so much harder to detect.
And your assessment would be that even with, I guess, various technology changes in the years ahead, there's often speculation about, you know, the oceans becoming somewhat more transparent or translucent with underwater detection technologies. Your assessment is that a nuclear-powered submarine fleet would still be a distinct advantage for Australia in the long time frame that we're talking here.
Absolutely, and I think there is no doubt that we're seeing a greater level of surface and above water surveillance capabilities by all nations, in particular by China in the South China Sea. So, our assessment would be that that in the years to come, in the near years to come, conventionally powered submarines would be detectable whenever they surfaced. I think the suggestion that the oceans are going to become transparent, that's probably still a while away. No doubt that technology will be pursued, but the nuclear-powered submarine will have a greater advantage as we see the increased use of technology in the undersea domain. I would fully expect that while there'll be advances in communication and detection techniques underwater, we're not going to see the oceans become transparent anytime soon.
Right, let's turn to AUKUS itself because, of course, it's not the only strategic or diplomatic or capability response that Australia's made to this much more challenging strategic environment with the rise of China's military power and China's ability and willingness to project force. But it is, by the time we publish this podcast, it will be a year since the AUKUS agreement was announced by the three leaders of Australia, the United States, and the United Kingdom. Why is AUKUS, in your view, such a significant part of Australia's response to this tough strategic outlook? What is the main purpose of AUKUS, or are there multiple purposes here?
I think there's multiple purposes, Rory. I think from the outset, the AUKUS agreement is significant. Is that it formally allows Australia to get access to military technology of the like that we've not had access to before. And clearly, the nuclear-powered submarine is the masthead program there. The reality, of course, is that Australia and US were great allies and have been for over 100 years, and the relationship and partnership that we have with the UK has always been strong. But we've not been in that position of sharing the most sensitive military technologies. notwithstanding the fact that we're like-minded and we're committed to a free and prosperous Indo-Pacific, what AUKUS gives us is a true commitment to ensure that Australia has the best technologies available and that we work together with experienced partners to deliver platforms and capabilities that will make us a very strong, very capable, and ultimately interoperable and interchangeable partner with our key allies and partners. And I think ultimately, Rory, it signals that the government and Australia is really serious about ensuring that we have the best possible platforms and equipment for our defence force in these challenging times.
Now, we know that AUKUS is more than submarines. There's an advanced capabilities stream to the agreement as well, and a growing list of advanced technologies where there's a commitment to work very closely together and in a trusted way. But let's stick with submarines for a moment. Some of the commentary seems to assume that the submarine pathway will boil down to a very straightforward choice between either the British Astute-class submarine or the American Virginia-class submarine. Do you see it this way, or are there more unique and complex options that you think could be considered, at least hypothetically?
Yeah, look, I think the role of the task force led by Vice Admiral Jonathan Meade, you know, their work over the last 12 months, and it remains ongoing, is to determine that optimum pathway. And I think that as the three nations explore what the options look like, there has certainly been a realization that that it may not be straightforward. And certainly, from my perspective, I think there's great advantages in the Astute. I think there's great advantages in the Virginia. But ultimately, the decision of what the platform will be needs to best meet Australia's needs. And so I could see that it would be a combination of the, I guess, the advantages that both platforms bring. Neither platform is perfect for Australia, but they both have some very strong attributes. Clearly, the DNA of the submarine will be predominantly one of those designs, but I would say that the ultimate, you know, the final product could have attributes and features or systems that may come from the other design, or in fact new technologies that might be coming along. As we know, the Astute is a well-established submarine. The UK are already looking towards what their next generation nuclear attack class submarine will look like. Similarly, for the US, the Virginia, we're now seeing the Block 4 variant there. So, you know, I think that the role of the task force, Rory, is to look at what those best attributes are. So I think that we are likely to see something that is unique for Australia's purposes. But unique doesn't necessarily mean that it needs to be more complex. What it could be is a combination of proven technologies and proven systems that Australia has experience with or can readily adapt to. That is designed into a submarine that meets Australia's purposes.
And it's useful that you've given that point of clarification there, because I think one of the concerns that many express, of course, are the timelines, the cost, and in a sense, the more unique the challenge we're taking on here is that potential to escalate those even further. But let's go to some of the risks and costs, if I may, Mike, because any massive strategic, diplomatic, industrial undertaking like this, I mean, in some ways I see this almost as a nation-building project for Australia, It comes with risks and costs, and AUKUS actually stands out in some ways for the scale of the challenge. So what do you see as the main risks ahead?
Well, I think anything of this nature, Rory, requires great investment. Great investment of finance, great investment of energy, and great investment of human capital. So as I look at everything that we have done so far to deliver AUKUS, both in the lead up to the announcement and the 12 months since, it has been a tremendously demanding period, and many people have worked very hard to get to where we've got to. The reality, of course, is that we're still at the tip of the iceberg in terms of the submarine and the other capabilities, and it's going to take a lot more energy and a lot of involvement by many people in very in a variety of roles across the country, I think as I think through that, the real challenge is the human capital aspect, and certainly as Chief of Navy, I put a priority on people, and I don't see that changing. For AUKUS, we're going to see a lot of good people needed for the design phase of the submarine. We're going to need a tremendous amount of talented people and committed people to build the submarines here in Australia. And, of course, there'll be ongoing collaboration with our UK and US colleagues as we do that. And then ultimately the Navy has to operate these submarines. So, again, there'll be another high demand for highly trained, highly skilled, highly committed people to operate these submarines in the 2030s, 2040s, 2050s and beyond. And then the industry, both defence and civil nuclear, that will be required to support the operation of the submarines and the regulation of these capabilities will, again, require a lot of people. So I think we're really just scratching the tip of the iceberg in terms of what this does mean for the country. You mentioned the term nation building. Absolutely it is. And I think that what we will see going forward is people in all walks of life somehow becoming touched and involved and contributing to this national endeavour. We will see an evolution in STEM training through our primary schools, our secondary schools, and our university, which will ultimately lead to the development of human capital in Australia that will contribute to this great enterprise.
And if I can add to that, it's going to require some very clear signalling and coordination to the education sector, if you like, the roles to play. I've noticed in the last 12 months a lot of interest, a lot of momentum, a lot of goodwill, particularly among universities here. You know, they want to get involved both with existing educational offerings and really developing new and tailored offerings and building their pool of talent from often a fairly modest base. So I guess I would just venture to say that this is going to have to be signalled very clearly, and I think we're all looking forward to those signals coming out at least at the end of the pathway process in March of 2023. I don't know if you've got anything to add to that, Mike.
No, I agree entirely with that, Rory. I think this is not just about the Navy. This is a national enterprise, and that skill requirement that you've alluded to is absolutely fundamental here. I think we heard a lot about nuclear-powered submarines when AUKUS was announced 12 months ago. But since then, you don't hear about it daily. Of course, there is so much else going on within the nation. But this enterprise, this commitment to the pathway is going to be something that we are going to need to sustain for many, many years. And we're going to see a tremendous change in the character of the Australian education system, of engineering writ large across Australia, an understanding of nuclear power and nuclear engineering will become a fundamental part of STEM in Australia.
So any students listening to this, if it's nuclear engineering or nuclear physics that's vaguely your thing, it's time to really explore those opportunities, I suspect.
We'll be right back.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Let's move to another risk, if you don't mind, Mike, looking at the question of the capability gap that's often raised. The question of time frames, looking at the future of the Collins class submarine, already very long in service, and the talk or the risk of a capability gap between when we no longer have potentially a viable Collins fleet, and we perhaps don't yet have that nuclear-powered submarine fleet in service. And, of course, the dangers in the strategic environment where they're to do with coercion or aggression or miscalculation, risk of conflict, this stuff is not going to adjust according to Australia's submarine-building timeline. So what do we do about a possible gap?
Yes, thanks, Rory. That's a question that I think I was asked every time I fronted Senate estimates. And I guess my thinking is, well, the capability gap is something you could debate forever. The reality is we've got what we've got until we've got something different. The Collins-class submarines, as you mentioned, they are a great submarine, and in many ways, they have proven themselves to be one of the most successful conventionally powered submarines in the world. And they've certainly served our Navy and our country with distinction. But they are aging. The spiral upgrade programs that we continue to see for those submarines are very important. And, of course, the Life of Type extension program, which will begin in 2026, will see each submarine not only, rebirthed for a further 10 years of service, but we'll see significant improvements to the propulsion train, to the sensors, the sonar systems, and ultimately the operation of the submarine. But you're right, they will have a life that may in fact lead to a capability deficiency. I wouldn't necessarily go as far as to say a capability gap as we transition from this to the next. Again, the work of the task force with respect to what the next submarine will be and the timeline it will be delivered in is very important here, and I know that government and defence are both very focused on ensuring that timeline is as tight as possible, and that will be a key consideration in determining the design, the build, and the delivery strategy for the submarine. I guess that's where we are with the submarine. The reality, though, of course, is that there are other programs and systems and platforms that are being pursued. both inside and outside of AUKUS, that will address the capabilities that that we are going to need going forward.
So you don't necessarily mean submarines in that sense.
That's correct, and you know, there are a number of other things that I know that are being explored in the undersea domain, for example, that will provide capabilities that will contribute and enhance Australia's security in the undersea domain that are not just submarines. The Hunter class frigate, for example, based on the Type 26 frigate of the UK, will contribute to Australia's undersea security.
Although that itself has pretty long timelines, controversially.
It does, it does. And again, the existing fleet, surface fleet, is more capable than it's ever been in terms of its ASW attributes. So while the submarine is a centrepiece of the undersea warfare domain, it's not the only piece. And there will be, I fully expect that we'll see new technologies exploited and explored in the next decade that we're not even using now. So I think there's that. AUKUS also, of course, is going to deliver military technologies in hypersonics and countering hypersonics. We've seen a great commitment and focus on cyber. And all of these elements of capability will come together and contribute not just to the undersea domain strategic environment, but also to the surface and above surface as well. So, I think that while some commentators talk about the capability gap, I think what we are going to see is a range of new technologies and a range of new capabilities that will contribute not only to the undersea domain, but to all of the domains in which the Australian Defence Force work.
And I note that one of the areas of work in the advanced capabilities side of AUKUS is actually unmanned underwater vessels. So I guess that's fitting in that family of capabilities as well, in your view.
Oh, absolutely. And we've seen a commitment now for some years from government and defence in the unmanned space. The Navy just recently ran the Autonomous Warrior exercise down in Jarvis Bay. Some great advances there, some great technologies on display, and great collaboration with partners both in industry and overseas. The government's commitment to the extra large UUV and the signing of the contract with Anduril recently is hugely exciting. It's a space that we've not operated in before. But all of these things absolutely contribute to that unmanned space and ultimately exploiting and exploring what we can do in the undersea domain.
So just a couple of questions and thoughts before we wind this up. Still on risks and challenges in a way, I'd like to turn a little to the international context, the various international reactions and international relationships that were affected by the AUKUS announcement that still matter to Australia in other ways. So it's been about a year since AUKUS was announced. There was a wide range of international reactions, and some of them were pretty challenging, pretty troubling, I think, for Australia's interests at the time. And I'm thinking, for example, the reaction of France, the reaction of some countries in Southeast Asia. But Australia is trying to build a web of international partnerships, some of which work in the realm of hard security, some of which work in the realm of highly close, trusted capability building, some of which work more at a diplomatic level or in terms of bringing a comprehensive balance of power to bear. And AUKUS has an impact on many of those in different ways. Where do you see AUKUS in the context of all of our other international partnerships, and what's your sense of how the international reactions are tracking?
Oh, I think winding back, firstly, Rory, the announcement of AUKUS really was a great surprise. It was a surprise nationally. It was a surprise regionally. It was a surprise internationally. And I guess in that context, it's not surprising that we saw a range of reactions because people hadn't had the opportunity to digest what had just been announced. And for a country like Australia that has not had a history of operating nuclear power submarines, this would be hugely surprising. And it of course takes time to be able to explain to stakeholders what this means, both holistically, but most importantly, what does it mean to them and the ongoing relationship with us? It was very important to disabuse any suggestion that this was an avenue for Australia to become involved in nuclear weapons, for example. And that was always crystal clear that there was absolutely no intention or desire or ambition to be involved in that side of things. But 6 months, 9 months down the track, people were still asking that question. So it takes time to clarify and for that message to be fully understood. The issue of nuclear proliferation is something that is hugely sensitive. It's very important. And again, you know, the assurance by government, by defence, by people involved in this decision, that provides absolute assurance that that this is not a pathway for nuclear proliferation, is very, very important. What I was able to experience in the international arena in which I had contact was once the explanation of why we were doing this was clear, and this was all about Australia's ability to continue to operate its submarines in a way that the government would choose to, in the areas that we choose to operate, when we choose to operate, for as long as we choose to operate. It was not about challenging anybody else's sovereignty, and it certainly wasn't about undermining or in some way dismantling the very important international relationships that we have both bilaterally and multilaterally throughout the region. And so I saw a marked shift from the initial reaction of shock to one of acceptance to one of embracing the fact that Australia was taking the security and the prosperity of the region so seriously, and that AUKUS as a access to technology in no way undermined or affected the very important international relationships that we enjoy both regionally and across the world. You mentioned the French and, of course, their reaction. Of course, it was one of shock. It was one of disappointment to have gone so far down the path of exploring the production of the attack class submarine in Australia to something that was very different came as a huge shock. But here we are, 12 months down track, military and government relationships with France have improved significantly. And there's a commitment to doing more together militarily in the Indo-Pacific, which I think is tremendously encouraging and important, because we do share this region with France, and they're a great friend and they're a great partner. I think what we have seen in the last 12 months is a commitment by the three AUKUS partners to be stronger in the Indo-Pacific, and we shouldn't discount the fact that in the last 12 months we've seen China commission 9 new destroyers, 2 amphibious ships, and a nuclear-powered submarine. And so that puts it into context that we can't sit idly by and expect that we will be able to remain a credible defence power and presence in the region if we don't explore the best possible technologies and platforms.
Look, thanks for that articulation, and I think that there are obviously still some challenges in those international relationships, and in a future podcast we'll have some other guests who'll help unpack those. But I agree there has been significant change in the international responses over the past 12 months. It does, I guess, beg the question in my mind whether we could have got the messaging better from the outset. And that, I appreciate, is to a large degree a question of diplomacy. But I want to go finally to one relationship in particular, and that is with the United States, because there would be no AUKUS without the United States. Indeed, Australia's security outlook would be profoundly different if the United States was not such a formidable ally and partner in the Indo-Pacific. So my question is, what do you think AUKUS tells you, what does AUKUS tell us about the direction of American and Australian strategy in the Indo-Pacific in the years ahead?
I think what it does underline in the first instance, Rory, is that we have got a great history of working together, both operationally, in people-to-people contacts, and now obviously what AUKUS gives us is that ability to explore technology. We have had modest exchanges over the years with respect to the combat system in the Collins-class submarine, for example, the Mark 48 heavyweight torpedo collaboration. That they have been works where we have had complete collaboration. Moving forward under AUKUS, I see that all of that collaboration will and can only deepen. We would seek to do more with the US in terms of guided weapons. To the point that we're now looking of the guided weapons industry in Australia, how we would potentially build and service guided weapons interchangeably with our key partner and ally. I think that our commitment to nuclear-powered submarines provides an opportunity for the US to operate in this region more frequently, and we've heard statements from the US Secretary for Defense, from the Commander of Indo-Pacific Command, and of course the Commander of Pacific Command, to operate more regularly in our region. A base on the east coast of Australia, I think, is something that we will see occur, and that also provides an opportunity for US nuclear powered submarines to operate and potentially undertake maintenance here, which is hugely important, and it's a great opportunity, not just to strengthen our military ties, but to deepen our industry capabilities and ties as well. So I think all of this, Rory, is underpinned by the fact that not only is our military alliance a strong one, but our shared commitment to the security and prosperity of the Indo-Pacific is absolutely in lockstep, and is one. And what AUKUS does is allows Australia to be a stronger partner, a stronger ally to the US, and to be able to be more helpful in terms of our contribution to maintenance, to our contribution to delivery, to our contribution to options, and our contribution to sharing all of those things across not just the maritime domain, but ultimately the land, air, and space domains as well. And, I think what AUKUS does do, it takes an extremely strong and important alliance to the very next level. I often use the term interchangeability as I talked about the US Navy and the Australian Navy. I think what AUKUS does for us with the US is it makes us more compatible, more interoperable, and ultimately more interchangeable in all of those domains.
Lots more questions we could go to, but I'm conscious that this has already been, I think, a very rich conversation, and we do have a few more podcasts in this series where we will go into issues like non-proliferation, regional reactions, and more. So, look, I'm going to wind that up there and thank our special guest once again for his time and insights today. So Vice Admiral Michael Noonan, who was Chief of the Royal Australian Navy during the inception of AUKUS, thank you very much for joining us on the National Security Podcast.
Thanks very much, Rory, and all the best for the rest of the series.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.